So, if you're all comfortable, then I will begin. Even if you're not comfortable, I'm going to begin anyway. So, for this evening's talk, the subject is going to be ultimate truth. Very simple subject, probably said it before. But the reason why is I got two emails during the week, and they all mention ultimate truth. So if you want to find out what ultimate truth is, hang on to your seats because here it comes. So first of all, as soon as I hear the word ultimate truth or ultimate anything, I think, how many times have I heard that? This is the ultimate, and after the ultimate truth, you've got the more ultimate, then the most ultimate, then the extreme ultimate, and the supreme extreme ultimate, and the unsurpassable extreme most supreme ultimate. And it keeps going on like that. I don't know why we do such things. But I just went to this conference, and they always, start calling you sort of venerables and most venerables. Because apparently, if you've been a monk more than 40 years or a nun more than 40 years, in some places they call you most venerable. So there's no more you can do after that, is there? If you're the most venerable, you might as well just retire because there's no more place to grow. You're the most venerable, like the most fat. If you become the most fat, I mean, you can eat whatever you like because you can't put any more weight. It's the ultimate extreme. So a lot of that is sometimes, what are people actually doing, calling it the most or extreme this? And it's just like, just judging and being one little bit better. They have VIPs, then you have VVIPs, and then you have EVVIPs, that's extreme most venerables, or very, very important, whatever it is. So all of those little titles, that even mentioning that I'm over 40 years as a monk now, and this is actually traditional Buddhism. After 10 years as a monk, you are called Thera. After 20 years as a monk or a nun, Mahathera. After 30 years, nothing, still the same. So that can't be right. So I decided after 30 years, after Mahathera, means big, it's Megathera. And after Megathera, what is the next one? Gigathera. That's me. Well, it's not Giga, it's Giggle. Gigglethera. Gigglethera. And after 50 years, it's Teratera. Or something like that. But why do we always have these grades and positions and status? There's something about that which never ever made sense to me in religious life. In religious life, it's supposed to be simple and just not conceited and not to put yourself up on pedestals or big thrones. It's supposed to be like a simple life where we try to not compare one another or say that this is better than the other. Because once you start to compare and measure, I'm betting that's where we start the ultimate, especially with ultimate truth. That's where we get all these arguments from. My ultimate truth is more ultimate than your ultimate truth. And that is ultimately silly. So, ultimate truth, what does that actually mean? First of all, you shouldn't even judge or compare. But number two, if you get to ultimate truth, what does that actually mean? That means you don't have to do anything else. You're lazy. I know, and you all have to believe my ultimate truth. But really, the whole idea of truth is like more like work in progress. Never think you've got the end to the end of knowing. There's always something else which you haven't seen yet. Something else you can work on. Something else you can improve. Just look, you were saying, how many years have we had Bodhinyana Monastery now? 33, 34? 34! You know, I put so much work and effort into building that place. I built it, and at that time, those people there at the time, no, I really put so much effort in there because I thought, I was working on the assumption, you build it once, you build it well, you don't have to do it again. That was my assumption. And I really did build it well. until other monks came along and decided, well, we can build it more well. And they knocked down all the wonderful things which I did, and they built it again. And even the plumbing over there, it was done perfectly. And where all the lines were, and then they said, no, we've got to do it again. And something which I've noticed, whether it's renovating a house, whether it's building a monastery, whether it's building a Buddhist temple, it's never ever finished. It's always, and will always be, work in progress. If you have a garden, are you going to finish it yet? No. It's always work in progress. Elizabeth Key, never be finished. Work in progress. It's nobody's fault, that's life. So, on that subject, so if it's always work in progress, you can never get to the ultimate end of your house, the perfect house where you can live there happy ever after, the perfect solution to your problems, the perfect relationship. Perfect relationships. It's always, again, work in progress. Sometimes people get married and think, well, this is it, the marvelous partner, now we'll live happy ever after. No. Work in progress. It always will be that way, won't it? But how can you have a break every now and again? A work in progress, the old simile, it comes in here. It's one of the most brilliant little pieces of insight which came from this monk, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, Ajahn Buddhadasa. He was building his hall and he knows what perfection is, how to have a really ultimate perfection. And this was when, start of the retreat period, he sent all the builders home. And somebody came a week later and they said, when's your hall going to be finished? And he said, it is finished. What do you mean, it's finished? There's cement bags all over the place. There's holes in the ceiling. Have any of you gone to see Bodhinyana Monastery recently? In the gate, the entrance gate, Bodhinyana Monastery, there's lots of holes in the gate, on the roof. There's lots of tiles missing because we had a gate crasher, literally. A big bus came in and crashed the gate. So there's lots of tiles, but it's brilliant. So when are you going to fix that? We're not going to fix it. It's fashionable. How many of you have seen these young women wearing these jeans with holes in them? So we've got holes in our gate, it's fashionable. So, you know, we're always ahead of fashion in Buddhism, so we've got like a holy gate with holes in it, so you can see through it, some broken tiles. Just like it's really hard to get that is Buddhist architecture. Now, a gate with holes in it, not perfect, always needs to be fixed. When are you going to fix it? Work in progress. But anyway, this fellow. Why does it have to be perfect? You know, I've been to some of those monasteries, absolutely perfect. They're like museums. There's no dharma there, there's no life in there. It's just, you know, trying to have some idea of perfection. And of course, after a while, it all fall apart. So, this fellow, Ajahn Buddhadasa, he said, the hall is, when's the hall going to be finished? He said, it is finished. Like that, leaving it alone. And this is where he said this beautiful statement. Now this really is a part of ultimate truth. He said to this gentleman, what's done is finished. And he went off to meditate. And I thought, isn't that brilliant? In your life, there's always more work to be done, more emails to be answered, there's more teeth to be brushed, there is more, I don't know what else you're doing this weekend, there's more jobs which your wife has to give you to do, otherwise she'll divorce you. Or there's more stuff which you have to do. I mean, when's it going to be finished? 43 years I've been a monk. I'm still having to give talks. Still 34 years we've had Bodhidharma Monastery, and there's still stuff which needs to be done. And you've only been president for 2 years? Past secretary, 4 years, okay. Still stuff to be done. When's it going to be finished? So what we do is we say, what's done is finished. Which means you can let it go. You can have some peace in your life. That is part of ultimate truth. The ultimate truth is seeing a little bit further and deeper. And you know it's ultimate truth because it gives you peace and freedom and happiness. You know, I was telling somebody that in the first years over at Bodhinyana Monastery in Serpentine, I stayed in one of the small A-frames. It's been torn down now. But I used to sit there on a Friday evening, just, you know, had the upper place in the A-frame, and just watch the Southwest Highway and see all the cars, see the headlights going down south for the weekend. And on Sunday evening, I saw all the headlights of the cars coming back again. And I think, what are you guys doing? You go this way and you go back. Why don't you just stay where you are? All that petrol wasted. And they said, what do you do that for? We want to get away from it all. What do you mean get away from it all? You can see all the cars there going with you. You're taking it with you. So what's done is finished. So what that means is you pause. You stop. You stop this relentless moving, doing, going, making, changing, improving. You stop for a little while and just see what you've got. And you know, if you actually stop searching for ultimate truth, if you stop trying to make things more perfect, if you stop trying to improve yourself or improve the person you live with, you come to a great realization. This is as good as it gets. So I'm going to enjoy this moment. You learn how to relax and let things be and enjoy life with another perception. Instead of trying to improve it all the time, leaving it alone and understanding just what beauty truly is. I remember one of the first stories which I wrote in one of those books, haven't said it for such a long time, about the person who they spent so much time getting a nice garden in the back of the house. And on the weekend they decided just to take a break. So what did they do? They put a chair out in their garden and just to relax. But what did they do? They read a book about gardening. That's not relaxing. That's doing research. That's more work. Put it aside. So they put the books aside and then they got out the radio to the gardening program. It's more work. Shut up. Keep it simple. Just sit there. And so they sat there. No book, no radio, no iPhone. Just sit, doing nothing. And then they started thinking, you know, I should really, before I actually relax, I should actually mow the lawn. And I should actually, you know, rake up all those leaves. And I should water the flower bed. And I should prune the bushes. And I should plant this there and that there. That's more work. So I told them, if you want to understand the meaning of life and ultimate truth and real beauty, put your seat out there, sit down, and say, even though the lawn needs mowing, even though the leaves need raking, even though the bushes need pruning, and the trees need, well, I don't know what they need anyway, they need treeing. Not now. Not now. This is good enough. What's done is finished. And be able to sit there without this compulsive, addictive, having to improve things mind. Just to sit there with all of the mess of your garden, sit there and appreciate it. Learn how to see peace and beauty in things which are all over the place, which are not the sort of perfection which you've expected, But when you're still and peaceful and rested, you can see things way more deeply. This is the ultimate truth, which comes when you stop seeking things, when you stay still. And what is it you see? You see that ultimate truth is not a thing, but the way you look at things. It is not an idea or a concept or a dogma. It's the way that you relate to all the different ideas people have, all the different parts of nature. It's a relationship, stupid. The relationship, not the thing. It's how you look at life, not what life is. That is where we find not ultimate truth, but ultimate relationship. If we have ultimate, what actually is it? Love, kindness, peace. That is not inherent in you or in what you experience. That is describing a wise way of living, which is between you and that relationship. I'm not sure if I said this last week, but I've been saying this a lot in my journeys. Because, you know, a few weeks ago I went up to my old university, Cambridge, and I always remember just, you go into, when I was young, first going there, you went into this Cavendish laboratory, and it was just an amazing experience going in this old laboratory where so much stuff had happened. It was a warren of alleys and little rooms where someone in one of those rooms was inventing the time machine, and no one knew what they were doing. These old professors no one had seen. Someone was inventing a laser and had all this incredible history behind it. J.J. Thomson had discovered the electron, and I always remember the room where the Kiwi genius Rutherford had split the atom. And you go around and they'd show you all these little places where things had happened and where things were still happening. It had just incredible atmosphere because it was old. I know one of the things there, they took me inside the tea room at the old laboratory in Cambridge. And everybody, all the professors and researchers, they all had to go into the tea room twice a day, morning and afternoon tea. And those tea rooms, there was the formica, the old plastic surface tables, and they would always have felt-tip pens there. So all these incredible physicists would actually go there, people like Hawkins would be there, and they'd scribble their equations while they're having a cup of tea and a cream bun. And they'd scribble those equations there, and their friends would come and say, oh, this is wrong, what about doing this? That was where they had the synergy. So many breakthroughs happened in that tea room. But these days, when it's coffee, they don't have so many breakthroughs these days. It's the tea, that was the most important part of, you know, the so, anyway, so I always thought, when they showed me that, and it was true, for years they were doing this, writing their equations, I always looked at the tea ladies and really wondered where there were Russian spies who, as soon as they finished their tea, would photograph the tea tables where all of the great scientists of Cambridge would put down their equations. But it did have atmosphere. And I always remember that room where Rutherford split the atom, because the idea of an atom was the indivisible, ultimate reality of stuff. Came from the Greeks. You can't split it. This is what stuff is made of. And of course, he really caused a lot of problems by showing it's not indivisible. It's made of subatomic particles, and those subatomic particles are made of even sub-subatomic particles, and they are just made of sub-sub-subatomic particles. And you try and find ultimate reality, and it's work in progress. And they can't find the ultimate subatomic particle, the stuff which everything is made of. And they should have known this, because 2,500 years earlier, there was a bald-headed fellow under a tree in India, and he split the Atma. There's a lot of similarities because Greek, Sanskrit, they're both Indo-Aryan languages. You know what the Atma means? The indivisible soul, the self, the substance which beings are made out of. The Atma. And the Buddha split it into parts. Five khandhas, different consciousnesses. Wow! So similar to Rutherford. It's causing a lot of problems. And realize what you take to be your soul, your essence, is not a permanent thing. That is not ultimate reality. So you find out what that's made of. The sub-ultimate reality of the soul, and the sub-sub-soul, and the sub-sub-sub-sub-sub-sub-sub-soul. And you realize it's work in progress. Endless. So where does that leave us? But those of you who know a little bit of science, it's not the stuff which is the ultimate reality. It's the forces of nature. When I was a kid, it used to be the four forces of nature. Gravitational force, electromagnetic force, weak and strong magnetic forces. Now they've got three of those. Two of those were seen to be the same. Now only three. But you know those forces? They describe how things interact. They are the relationships between stuff, how things move through time and interact. That is the forces of nature. And the Buddha, he found the forces which interact between you and the person sitting next to you. That is the stuff of ultimate reality. It's not a theory. It's a relationship. How you relate to what you experience. That makes life very easy. It doesn't matter who you are, what religion you are, what race, how old, how sick, how stupid, how fat. It's not the fatness which is important, it's how you relate to it. That is really important. So, it makes it much easier for me to be able to watch my weight when there's so much of it. It's so much easier for me to sort of maintain my figure. When it's so big, you don't have to do very much to maintain it, except not do exercise. It's how you relate to things. Now that is the ultimate reality, and that actually has a lot to do with, you know, it's ultimate reality because it creates peace, harmony, freedom, joy, and happiness. Like happiness, that is part, that's why you know there's ultimate reality. That is why, you know, sometimes that, why do I keep telling jokes during Dhamma talks? What's that got to do with ultimate reality? A heck of a lot. Because it's a relationship you have to life. And sometimes being able to laugh at life and all the amazing people which live in this life, and weird ones, strange ones, angry ones, soft ones, all the things which make up this incredible forest, this jungle of humanity and other beings, how we relate to that, that is the stuff of life. And that's when we learn how to take it with some humor, with some joy and happiness. That adds another level onto what we call ultimate reality. Having joy no matter what happens in life. So for example, one of our monks, Venerable Mudita, I hope he's listening over in Newbury, in Victoria. He actually sent me an email. He said, I should tell you that the Victorian government has actually permitted voluntary euthanasia. And I wrote back a very quick reply, Venerable Mudita, don't do it. And he wrote back and said, that was so funny, I almost died. Now that's something which is really very nice. But anyway, so the joke for this evening, ultimate reality joke, I don't know if you actually heard this, that some university students up in the Northern Territory in Darwin, they're investigating a very weird phenomena. Because on the big highway, you know, going up to Darwin, they noticed the only roadkill they saw on there was actually crows, the crows being killed. They were only killed by trucks and buses, never by sedans. They looked there and sort of, and that was the rumor, the myth, and I actually checked that, it was absolutely true. Weird, but the crows would only be wiped out by the trucks and the buses, never by sedans. So once they established that fact, they wanted to find out the causes, the reason for it. And they discovered, after, you know, just doing some research, that when the crows, they go on the road to get some roadkill, they always leave one of their friends, their partner, on a tree as a lookout. And the crow on the tree, the lookout, knows how to say, car, 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 but doesn't know how to say, truck, truck, truck. Now, how does that feel now, your relationship to life? Now, that's an ultimate reality. You're having some fun, joy. There is something there which is part of truth and happiness and stuff which you want to aspire to. Wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have that wonderful sense of happiness and joy all the time? Imagine like permanent laughter. Or the feeling, not just the noise of the laughter, the feeling of it. You know, that's sometimes so close to love. Enjoying the relationship you have to life, no matter what it happens to be. That's interesting. The relationships you have. What happens when you're depressed? When things don't go right? When you miss your plane, when you lose an argument, when it doesn't go your way. Instead of going, why don't you laugh? Even when things, other people are actually shouting and crying and screaming and asking for things to change. A smile, even a laugh at life is not your crazy, but you're incredibly wise. It's a relationship. I've got the sack for work. Yeah! How many people complain about going to work? Somebody was just talking just before I came in here. She was saying, I'm not sure if this was personal or they saw a program about it, but so many people have their lunch stolen when they're at work. It's crazy stuff. And they said, I'm going to get in trouble here, that they were working at the university, and it was, they work in the geology department, and they actually staked it out, it was the geography department, they're the ones who stole their food. Okay, work that one out, but anyway, it just so happened. Today, we were talking about the same thing at lunch in, the coffee club, just after lunch. And there was one of the monks there, his mother was a nurse, I think still, well, maybe just retired, in Royal Perth, in a surgery department. And she always had the same problem. She'd have her sandwiches, put them in the fridge, they'd always be stolen. So she solved the problem so easily that one day she had a sandwich, instead of putting the normal filling in, she got some extras from the surgery department. It was actually a placenta. Yeah, it was really gross, but she put it in a sandwich one day, and from that day on, the sandwiches were left alone. There we go, that's something you remember when you go home this evening. But I wouldn't recommend to do that, you get in big trouble. But anyway, that's life, and that's a very interesting way of overcoming such problems. You know, with a bit of humour. So just like, you know, how we solved that problem with the first years at Bodhinyana Monastery, 34 years, because we were actually on the road to Karnat Prison Farm. And so, you know, some of the people, you know, when people are going to visit their friends, either on the way there or on the way back, they decided to, you know, take the opportunity to do a bit of business in our monastery by nicking things. We didn't have a wall up there, we just had a fence, and just people just easily go through the fence. So, how are we going to stop that? So we put up the notice, trespassers will be prosecuted. Do you think that stops anybody? No way. So, try again. And found a solution so easily, trespassers will be converted. That works so well. We still got another sign. It says the same. The original sign, I think, got stolen. But we've got a new sign there. Trespassers will be converted. That's really amazing. That's how you keep people out of here. So if ever we get too many sort of people coming in here who we shouldn't come in here, Mr. President, if you want to keep them out, or if, you know, if in your home, if you get any burglaries, just put President of the BSWA, trespassers will be converted. That will keep everybody out very easily. But it's also that people get a lot of fun and joy on that. It's amazing just how many people respect that. And because they respect that, then they will probably do the right thing. I was just writing some Christmas cards to my family over in UK, it's the time of the year. So I was just telling what happened recently, and you know, I was over in UK, and sitting on the underground train. Because it's really important. If you're a monk, you don't go in sedans or because they don't kill the crows. You don't just go in sort of limousines or whatever. You just go in public transport, just so you can meet people and find out how people feel. So I was actually in one of the public transport, in the underground train. Anyone who's been in the underground train in UK, you know that no one ever gets eye contact. They're always looking down, looking at the newspaper, they're looking at you, but you know, sort of, because you know, you're really weird, you're wearing a brown robe, and wonder that's something really big under his chair. Is that a suicide bomb or? Could be, you know, it's big under here. And so they were looking at that, and just this woman sitting next to me, she turned around and said, "Are you a Buddhist monk?" I said, "Yeah, I am." And she got quite excited. "A real Buddhist monk?" I said, "Yeah, cool." And so, you know, she wanted to actually talk about, you know, Buddhism. So talking along and said, "You know, what actually, you know, can tell us something about Buddhism?" And I said, "Oh, you know, and about sort of, you know, rebirth, because that's part of Buddhism. Are you locked? Sorry, you can't get out before the talk ends. I'm terribly sorry." We do. Of course you can. Go that entrance or whatever. Look, the jokes aren't that bad, are they? Oh, they can't. Go that way out there. We always say there's no entrance fee, but it costs $20 to go out. No, it doesn't. Get out. Okay, I owe you. Okay, so anyway, where was I? Oh yeah, on the underground train in UK, and talking about, and I told the story, I don't know if I told this last week, but anyway, here we go again, about on the recent retreat which we had, you know, just before the end of the rains, that was when the Singapore people came along, and one told me this, you know, not just people from Singapore, people from different countries as well, and this Italian guy, he said his weird dreams, because you know, you have these weird dreams, and they often ask monks, can you please... can you interpret these dreams for me? Because this was really, really strange. Because the first night he dreamt he was a piece of ravioli. It's strange, isn't it? Ravioli. He's Italian, obviously. And the second dream, the next night, he dreamt he was a strand of spaghetti. And he came up to me and said, "What does this mean?" And it's obvious. I said, "You're recollecting your past lives." Your past lives. So I told that on the tube, okay, on the underground. you know, and there's lots of people who can understand the situation. They're all looking down, but they were listening because nothing goes on there. This is weird, you know, because it got your attention too. Well, what's ravioli got to do with this? And as soon as I got to the punchline, he recollected, they all looked up from their newspapers and they smiled. I created happiness in an underground tube in the morning while people were going to work. I was so proud of that achievement. I'm going to remember that, you know, for the whole year. Got people to look up and actually look at me and smile. Some people groan, but at least they know their way of expressing happiness. Now, and I said, this is dumb. This is ultimate reality. Connecting with people, getting this beautiful relationship. It's how we meet together and just what we give to one another. The service, the giving, but not just any old giving. It's giving encouragement, happiness, support. Life is tough. And imagine just going to work, the same old tube every morning, no one looks at each other, just waiting to get to the end of the line, wherever you happen to be going to, and it's just so impersonal. But when you tell a joke, it's somebody's really connecting to you, and they're just uplifting you. And actually they're giving some love, some care, a gift of happiness and joy with a stupid little story from a weird Buddhist monk. That is the meaning of life. It's not maybe what you think should be like a philosophy, because those philosophers, they drive you crazy sometimes. You know, just big logical theories and just arguing with them is just whoa. It gets you nowhere. Because you know, it doesn't really matter who's right and who's wrong, it's just you know, who argues the loudest, basically. Who can quote the deepest philosophical treatise, or whatever it is. And whatever those things are, that there's something which is not real about them, something which is fake, which is plastic, which is not of the world. What is of the world, real life, is learning to, you know, to see the relationships we have with people. And also with yourself, with you, the ultimate reality of how you relate to yourself. Not who you are, or what is the essence of this life, the ultimate reality, but the reality of your emotional intelligence, your world, how you deal with all these amazing things which happen to you in life. Some are disappointments, that's food for another joke. Taking it in your stride, learning from it, never allowing it to take you down. Because you know that sometimes that people get so negative and it doesn't help. Blaming, complaining, doesn't help at all. I was going to read out a little story because I was telling this to somebody, I got the real story. And I got this from the Cancer Support Association some time ago. I'm just going to break all my rules and get it out because it was at the top of it here somewhere. It's all the work I've got to do. Where is it? Okay. Here it is. I got this years ago. 2007, wow. This is an autobiography in 5 chapters by a lady called Portia Nelson. Don't know where she is. Autobiography in 5 chapters. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I am lost. I am hopeless. It isn't my fault. And it takes forever to find a way out. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend that I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. But it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it is there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down another street. That's really beautiful sometimes because that's what happens in our life. We make a mistake. It's not my fault. And what happens? We eventually get out of that mistake and then we do it again. We pretend we didn't see it. It's not my fault again. And the third time, you do it again. It's a habit. But it's your fault. In other words, you don't blame it. Well, not really your fault, but you did it. You can't blame anybody else. You know, it's wonderful when you don't blame anybody else. Remember that saying of my teacher Ajahn Chah about blaming other people? Blaming other people for your suffering, for what's going on in your life, is like having an itch on your head and scratching your bum. It is so concise. That's why ultimate truths are like that. Anyone can understand. It's not philosophical, but my goodness, it's so true. Have an itch on your head and you scratch your bum, what happens? Does the itch go away? No. And you get another itch where you've just been scratching. Two itches when you should have known you had one. That's what blaming others. Falling in the hole, not my fault. And you stay there a long time. But yeah, it was my fault, I was a bit stupid. I should have scratched my head instead of scratching my bum. Just be a bit more careful next time. So that's why you walk around it the next time. You don't get stuck in the same problems. Same habits. And then lastly, you go down another street. You don't go there anymore. That is actually learning. Learning this emotional wisdom of knowing what life is like. So this is how we learn. And on the subject of falling in holes, that was when I was in Sri Lanka. There's many Sri Lankans here. When I was in Sri Lanka, it was amazing just what you can get up to. You manage to have a nice private session with the Prime Minister over there. And I repeated a story which I told to the previous president. And what you should talk to Turnbull and everybody else is the simile of the donkey. The simile of the donkey. A donkey was walking through the forest one nice afternoon and he fell in a hole, just like that story there. The hole was an abandoned well. So lucky that there was no water in the bottom of the well, and the donkey never managed to break any legs. It was just a bit bruised, but nothing else. So what did the donkey do at the bottom of the well? He couldn't climb out himself, so he started crying out for help. "Eo, eo, eo," said the donkey. And no one could hear it, so it went on for a long time. "Eo, eo." And even as a donkey, it was getting a bit hoarse. Ha ha ha. I couldn't resist stupid. That really is a stupid joke. But anyway, "Eo." And finally, a farmer came past. Wondered where that noise was, looked in the bottom of the well, and saw the donkey down there. And the farmer never liked donkeys, hated donkeys. So he thought, well, what can I do? And he said, "I can not kill two birds with one stone. Cut two carrots with the same knife." We have different similes in Buddhism. So, you know, appropriate ones. So don't ever say kill two birds, but cut two carrots with the same knife. So he decided, well, that's a very dangerous well. I always meant to fill it in. And that stupid donkey down there deserves to stay down there. So what can I do? Ha ha. He got a spade and started shoveling earth into the well. And the poor donkey wondered what the heck was going on. All this dirt was being thrown all over the donkey. That's why the politicians, they started to listen now, because that's what happened to politicians. In that life, you always have dirt thrown over you. So what does a donkey do? "Eo, eo! What are you doing? You're kidding me! Burying me alive! Eo!" But that just encouraged the farmer. More and more dirt was shoveled over the poor old donkey's back, getting more and more buried. And then soon the donkey became quiet. And the farmer thought, oh, I didn't realize I'd shovel so much earth in there, must be dead by now. But the donkey wasn't dead. The donkey was wise. He had an insight into ultimate reality, into the meaning of life. When people shove dirt all over you and it's not deserved at all, when they criticize you, they find fault with you, and it's nothing to do with the truth. What did the donkey do? Another shovel full of earth. He shrugged it off, stamped it in, and it became another centimeter higher. Another shovel full of earth, shrugged it off, stamped it in another centimeter higher. And so every shovelful of earth struck off, stamped it in another inch closer to the top of the well. And the farmer never really was paying much attention, thought the donkey was dead by now, so shovel it in. He never noticed a pair of ears appear above the top of the well. He kept on shoveling, shoveling, until the donkey was close enough to the top of the well. He just jumped out. And according to the story, when I first read it, to explain the law of karma to the farmer, he bit the karma's backside and ran away. Which was, the moral of the story is, must always watch your ass. That's how I read it. The donkey ass, okay. So that is how you deal with when things go wrong in life. When you get criticized for things you never did, when you get sick and you don't deserve it, when you get, I don't know, you get the banks take all the money from you, or whatever else is happening, whatever's happening in your life, what do you do? Shrug it off, stamp it in, and then you're more higher in life, closer. That is called ultimate reality. How you relate to all the difficulties in your life, such as having dirt thrown over you. So, real ultimate reality, work in progress, is how you relate to all the things. When you're having a good time, enjoy it. Don't feel guilty that you're happy or you're doing well in life. But when things go pear-shaped, then wonderful. Shrug it off. Learn from it. It's how you deal with things like sickness and loss. That is the meaning of life. The learning, your emotional intelligence. That is what we teach here. Da da da. That's it, folks. That's all you're getting tonight. So, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, come on. I know I've been away for a while, but sadhus. That's getting there. One more try, come on. Sadhu. 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 Now that is ultimate reality. You've got to do it anyway, so why not just give it, make it fun and energetic, you feel good. Okay, so now any questions from the floor, from the chairs, or from the old tablet? Here we go. There's always some questions, complaints, something or other from the old tablet. Very good, here we go. Okay. We have one from Scotland, one from Germany, and one from Malaysia. From Scotland. How important is it that a practicing Buddhist finds time each day to release any negative emotions and have a good cry? How important is it? If you feel like doing it, fine. If you don't feel like doing it, fine. Negative emotions, they come. If you want a good cry, wonderful. People used to cry a lot in my retreats. It must have been the chanting was just so bad. Oh, the quality of the jokes. But whatever it is, I always remember the story of this fellow who came on one of my retreats, an Aussie guy. He started crying while he was meditating. And he said, "What's going on here?" And then what I told him, I said, "When was the last time you had a cry?" And he said, "When I was about, I think about 11 or 12 or something. And my father said, men don't cry in Australia." I mean, a lot of times you can understand that. You've got to sort of, you know, hold it back, be a strong guy or be a strong girl, don't show emotions. And sometimes that is forced on us, even like, you know, in a place like this where, you know, you should feel that freedom to be loved and cared for no matter what happens. And so I told him that he had a lot of crying to do, to catch up on. He was about in his mid-40s. Imagine that, had been allowed to cry for 30 years. So you know, it's wonderful. He cried throughout the whole retreat, crying, 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 every day. And he felt so good afterwards. And I said also, there were so many girls who wanted to find out if he was single or if he... So guys, you know, it makes you very, very attractive. If you start crying and crying and crying because, and it's emotional. I shouldn't say that, but that was absolutely true. So anyway, find a good time each day to release any negative emotions, have a good cry. Why not? If you feel like it, don't think you have to. If you've got negative emotions, you feel like crying. It's also positive emotions make you cry as well. Inspiration. I know sometimes that, you know, you listen to something and it just makes so much sense. Oh, that's so wonderful. And tears of joy would come out. So, of me. So positive emotions make me cry as well. So if you need to, just stop. A place where, okay, my crying experience. This was, there is, in India, going on pilgrimage there, there's one place which, there was the most beautiful statue, you know, in, I still say it's the most beautiful Buddha statue ever. You know the one behind here with the big sort of circle around the aura? That's based on one which was found under the ground outside of Benares in the deer park. And it's there in the museum. You see many, many photos of it. And it's supposed to be one of the most beautiful. And so the first time I went there, I was looking for it. There was no directions in the museum outside of Sarnath. I was in Benares. So I was looking for it, and I finally found it at the end of a corridor. I don't know why, but that is just so, it gets me every time, just so emotional. It's beautiful. And it is, you know, one of the most perfect statues. And sometimes artists or poets, sometimes they get it. They capture something which is so amazing. You know, I can't do that, but some of these artists, they get inspired. Poets are the same, that sometimes capture a mood, a feeling, and it's incredible. And anyway, so I cried there. So the next time I went there with a group, I was prepared. So take a group in, we went to see the statue. I couldn't help myself. It just gets me every time. And I didn't mind doing it. But the third time I went there, I was prepared to have a good cry, my favorite statue. I was really prepared. I had all the tissues there ready, told all the people, just don't disturb me, I'm okay. You know what happened? It was covered. They were renovating, painting the damn ceiling. And so there they were painting, and the whole thing was covered. Oh, that just, you know, anticipation, expectations, you know, I teach people not to have these things, big hypocrite, Ajahn Brahm. So, that was so disappointing. And of course, the painter, you know, couldn't speak any English, but you know, the painter, without anyone saying anything, took the covering off. That was such a good cry, because, you know, it was so, from disappointment, going all that way, and you know, not seeing it, and then they took the cover off, and you saw it, and that's just amazing. So that was positive emotion, so crying, yeah, go for it. In Germany, I'm addicted to alcohol. I sometimes feel like my brain is fooling me. Who is in charge? Where does my world come from? Is it me or not me? It is me in Germany. I hope you're watching now. Which camera is it? This one or that one, by the way? That one over there. Okay, in Germany, you will not take any more alcohol. Ajahn Brahm is now in your brain. You will desist, or else. I don't know if that works or not. But anyway, no, because the fact that you've asked that question, you know, it means, you know, you see the problems of it. There's so many ways of overcoming that addiction. And don't think you can't do it. And sometimes, now, sometimes people say, okay, it's the brain that makes you take it. But, you know, sometimes it's not just the brain. It's sometimes the mind. Sometimes you can just literally say no. And those psychologists sometimes say, Ajahn Brahm, what are you talking about? You can just stop, say no. It's just, the mind can do that. If you believe that, if you can understand that the mind is so incredibly powerful, much more powerful than the brain, you can just stop it. Give it a try. Anyway, in Malaysia, different faiths often argue what is sentient and what is inanimate. For example, artificial intelligence, plants, microorganisms. How does the Buddhism discern this? What is sentient and what isn't sentient? So one thing you can do to find out is that sometimes there's a snake on the path, and sometimes is it asleep, is it dead? The thing to do is tickle it. (Laughter)
don't do that.
What is said or what is inanimate, for example, artificial intelligence parts? It is, again, what you can have a relationship with. I mean, sometimes you can actually feel that beings in the forest, especially these big beings. Oh, where was I saying this? That there's a couple of times, you know, when you're in the jungles as a young monk, that there's one time that you knew there was, what can you say, electricity in the air. You know, something strange, there's something really weird happening. And one of those times I turned a corner, it's this huge king cobra. And it was about sort of, I think it might be about, but you, people say that these things don't exist, but I saw it about 10 meters. Huge. And you know, you felt there's something there. The other weird thing which I saw, and I don't mind saying this, I'm not a crazy monk, that, well, some people say, but this time in the northeast of Thailand, close to the Burmese border, in my hut, meditating, you felt something was weird happening outside. Now, really unusual, you could feel that. So I opened my eyes, it came out, and in the air, in the sky, it was full. Now, every square meter had a bird in it. And weird. And up there, there was these two huge birds. And I remember going into Norway once and seeing a king's eagle. Scared the hell out of me, just huge. But it stood almost, you know, as tall as I was, up in the mountains. I didn't sort of go any further, I just turned around quietly and just walked away. That could really sort of damage you, kill you, huge bird. But this was bigger than that. Never seen such a bird like that, but there's two of them, and they were flying over the jungles. And all the other birds were out there as well, just, you know, what you think, maybe just paying respect to king, queen, bird of the jungle. And then sort of looked at them and thought, and my memory now is they were the mythical birds, Garudas. In Buddhist Buddhist mythology, Garuda birds. They're certainly nothing like I'd ever seen before, huge beings. So, weird things which are around in this world. And sentient, you feel them if they're sentient or not. So don't use your even the science or what it should be sentient, what it isn't sentient. It just, minds connect with minds. It's the relationships, what you can form a relationship with, what reciprocates that relationship, what you can feel peace and love and care for. It's the interaction between things that is the ultimate reality of life. The forces of nature, not the things which make up nature. That's the ultimate reality. So there we go, folks. That's it for tonight. If you want episode 2 of Ultimate Reality, maybe, who knows, next week. But whatever it is, one of the most ultimate realities is whatever you expect it to be, it will be something else. Good night. So now pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi Suvakkato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato sāvaka-saṅgho saṅkhaṃ namāmi